You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Welcome to A Damn Fine Cup of Culture, and another in our summer season of genre. This month, we're looking at the fantasy genre, but focusing on that period in the 80s where post-Star Wars, Hollywood created a whole raft of fantastical epics. It's an era where the fantasy had to be created by puppets, animatronics, matte paintings, all sorts of trickery, which meant that I like to call this era the era of tactile fantasy. Joining me today to relive our childhood in this era is Sam. Hi, Sam.
Good morning, Alan.
And Matt. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Al.
I picked this genre because I have such fond childhood memories of this. And I think if you listed the films I saw first in the cinema, I think 90% of them probably would have fallen into this sort of world of dragons and puppets. But I was wondering, what was the sort of films that you remember from this era most, or any that you saw as a kid? So starting with you, Matt.
I would say that the first two fantasy films that I remember seeing were Jim Henson's Labyrinth in 1986 and Ron Howard's Willow in 1988. And I think both of those fit the topic of this episode quite nicely, because they are two of the last fantasy films that rely predominantly on puppets, miniatures, stop motion or go motion. But they're also two of the first fantasy films that use early CGI. There's a CGI owl in Labyrinth, and there's plenty of morphing in Willow. I don't know if you remember that short period where every film used morphing. And I have to say that I got into fantasy way before I got into fantasy movies, mostly through books, but also through video games. And I can't remember watching all that many films that I would call fantasy. I was aware of them, though. So, for instance, the film I've picked for this episode that we'll talk about later is one that I wanted to see but never got to see. I didn't go to the cinema that often on my own as a kid. And also, there's this thing that in the German-speaking world, genre fiction and speculative fiction was seen as trashy or children's fare. And because of that, you know, my parents also went into anything that was fantastical. So I just didn't see these things. The closest I came were probably watching Ghostbusters at the cinema and then Star Wars on videotape, which both, I think, share qualities with the films we're going to see.
How about you, Sam? When did you first sort of come across these tactile fantasy films?
Well, with The Neverending Story, and talking of videotapes, it was also the very first time I saw anything on a videotape at our neighbor's house, and she had The Neverending Story ready, and she was so traumatized by that one scene, you know, with a horse in the swamp. I think shortly thereafter, there was the sequel at the cinema. I also remember going to see Neverending Story Part 2, which was also this big early 90s effect movie. And I think only later did I then see things like Legend and Willow and obviously Star Wars on videotape first. I think for me, one other fantasy adventure experience that I remember really well is Hook by Steven Spielberg. I think that was also one that as a child was, you know, hugely advertised. There were all these tie-in books. And I also, I think through these films, got into the making of both of, I remember Neverending Story 2 and Hook. I had these books that really talked about the making of them, how the effects were created. And I think I blame these fantasy films of the 80s and 90s a little bit for really getting into, you know, wanting to find out what's behind the scenes, what's how these effects are made. And obviously, these are some of the best. Just before, I think, with Jurassic Park, then, of course, the big shift came towards CGI. And I remember that as well as this big new thing that came up. And of course, it also meant the end of that era that we're talking about today, I think.
I mean, definitely, I remember when CGI was being used in these films, and it just felt like one of the tricks alongside all the others. You know, it was as equally as valid. They did this with a puppet. They did this with a little bit of computer trickery. It felt part of the fun of trying to work out how all of this was done. And I have a very strong memory of when I went to see Labyrinth in the cinema. And it opens with a computer-generated owl. And I refused to believe it was computer-generated. I've been told it was. And I remember sitting there thinking, that is not a... I know computers. I've played on an Atari and a Commodore 64. That's not a computer. That's an owl. And really sitting there being like, I've obviously been mistaken on this. And then you watch it now, and it's obviously a computer owl. But I think it still had that level to impress, and to some extent maybe to trick you into thinking that this is something that might be real. And so, although I sort of say tactile fantasy, there is an element that CGI is in the mix, but it still was an era where it just felt like one of the tricks that was available to them. But I think, yeah, we're going to look at three films. We've all brought a film related to this genre to the table. And I think we're sort of going to look at them in chronological order. And that means starting with Matt. What film did you pick and why?
I picked Dragon Slayer from 1981, directed by Matthew Robbins and written by Hal Barwood. And I picked this one basically because it was a film that I was aware of as a kid, which is kind of surprising because I would have been 6 when it came out. I probably was aware of it being shown on TV when I was then 8 or 9. And I wanted to see it because I thought, you know, what, seeing a dragon in a film would be so cool. I'd seen animated dragons, of course. I might even have seen early, effects dragons, but they would have been, cheesy and not very good effects. So I just thought, I would love to see a dragon, especially because I remembered people saying, this is a film that really gets the dragon effects right. You believe, you'll believe a dragon can fly and spit fire and eat princesses or whatever. But I never got to see the film as a kid, not even as a teenager. And then basically that was just this film that I thought I should have seen that back then. And I finally remedied this for this episode because I thought, it's clearly a film that fits into this topic. Let's watch it. And I have to say that I wish I had seen it as a kid because it's not a very good film, even though it is a film that fits into this topic. And I would say of the three films we'll discuss, it's clearly the worst. But as a kid, I'm sure I would have eaten this up because, hey, dragon. And I think it gets the dragon mostly right. It stars Peter McNichol, Ralph Richardson. And in the casting already, I would say it's clearly a post-Star Wars film. You've got Ralph Richardson as the kind of cynical rewriting of the Obi-Wan template. You've even got Ian McDiarmid in a small part. And some surprisingly strong female parts for the time. And the writing has some neat ideas. But I would say that the problem is the protagonist is basically horrible. He's an arrogant, untalented brat and he barely develops during the film. Basically, I just wanted him to be eaten by the dragon as quickly as possible so that the women could take over. But the film is called Dragon Slayer and half of that word is already a key to the film. The main attraction is the dragon. And I would say the dragon works really well, mostly. For the first half of the film, it's shown in ways that reminded me of Jaws. You see just enough of the dragon to get the viewer's imagination going, but not so much that the more shaky effects are too visible. And the go motion puppetry is really, really good. It's just a shame that for the last third or so, for the film's conclusion, the effects, especially the blue screen work, look pretty bad. But the build-up is really good. And, this is a film where the special effects were made by Industrial Light and Magic, and that's where Sam's earlier statement about making-ofs comes in. During that time, I was such a big fan of Industrial Light and Magic because they really did magic in their special effects. Did either of you see this film as a kid?
No, this was very much the first time I watched it was for this podcast. This one, I think, passed me by. And I think I agree with you. I think I would have loved to have seen this as a kid where you can enjoy what's good about it. Whereas I think as an adult, it's a lot harder to forgive it its deficiencies. But I think, yes, I really enjoyed The Dragon. And another aspect of this, which I think is part of this genre in the 80s, and I'm not quite sure why this was, but it's surprisingly dark. Loads of these films are quite bleak. They have quite nasty moments. And I think I agree, this, as was being said earlier, this genre was written off as childish, that adults thought this was silly in the 80s, which was why I got to see a lot of it, because they said, oh, this is for kids. Alan's a kid. Pack him off to the cinema to watch dark films like this. And there are moments in this. There's the first sort of virgin getting killed is quite a sort of brutal Jaws-like moment. And there's sort of people being burned alive that isn't really hidden off camera. I think one of the characters that you begin to empathize with has a brutal demise. And then we see the corpse in quite bloody detail. And actually, I think this stuff, if I had seen this as a kid, this would have been cool as well. I think I would have come out of the cinema thinking, had an excellent dragon and you had some excellent nasty moments. What a great film. And I think watching it as an adult, there's all the bits in between that it's just not very well written. And I think that the weakest part, which is probably one of the reasons why maybe people didn't stick with it, it opens really poorly. It kind of plunges you in this world. And the writing is really clunky for like the first 10, 15 minutes. It's like, what is going on? Why should we care about any of this? And it's only a little bit later that we kind of get a view of the world of, it's a world where there's a lottery to send a virgin off to be killed by a dragon, and that keeps the world safe from a dragon. And you kind of think, I would have led with this. Because instead, we have a lot of like very boring Ralph Richardson as the old wizard, a guy who's sort of a bad guy, who's being mean, can't really see the reason. It's all over the place. I was sitting there thinking, like, what is going on? And then it finally gets to sort of the conventional fantasy story, and I'm like, ah, there's a real sense of relief. And the other bit of adult baggage that definitely made me struggle with this film is obviously that the lead, who is the sort of Luke Skywalker on this, went on to have a bit of a career as a far more comedy actor. He's great, I think, in Adam's Family Values. I immediately recognized him from that. And he tends to, in a few years' time, he gets a good career out of playing these slightly petulant, slightly prissy figures of fun. They're the person in a comedy film that is too uptight that becomes a little bit, I think, the target of the humor. So he's running the summer camp in Adam's Family Values and is obviously the perfect target for Wednesday's attitude in that film. And because he's so good in that role, I could not take him seriously in this. When he wanted to emote something genuine, when he wanted to be the sort of young, arrogant guy who's going to save the day, I just kept expecting him to be the sort of petulant guy that he was to play, especially into the 90s. I wouldn't have had that baggage as a kid, but it was like a weird thing that kept throwing me out the film. The moment he'd speak and it's such a recognizable voice, I would be like, yeah, he doesn't care. Of course he doesn't care. He's this arrogant guy from all these other films. And it was really hard to shake off. So I think the sort of young, I could watch it thinking young me would have really enjoyed this, but old me less so. How about you, Sam?
Well, it's so interesting because Peter McNichol, I knew mostly from Sophie's Choice. And I, you know, had the, not the opposite effect, but I knew him as a dramatic actor. And then I thought, oh, he started out here, which was, I think, just the year before that he got this role. And, you know, he worked well enough for me. I thought he was a little bit, you know, less, obviously less prolific, less noticeable here as a true hero figure. He was a bit more unusual to me than maybe I had expected. But I do agree. I got into the film and it took me a long time to really feel the world building was working here. I thought the first interactions with Ralph Richardson and this group that comes to seek his advice and comes up to the castle was awfully long. And I didn't quite know where this was going. It was partly quirky. I enjoyed his quirky performance. And he must have enjoyed also playing a wizard in a big fantasy film like, you know, Alec Guinness a few years before. And then, yeah, once the dragon shows up and obviously this terrible sacrifice happens, I thought, ooh, this is dark. This is different. And I think a lesser film with a smaller budget, maybe a slightly more independent fantasy film could have gotten away with this. Maybe a first time director making this. But for a film that had obviously a big effects budget and lots of people who had also worked on Star Wars and Indiana Jones and, you know, all these big productions at the time, I think it really fell flat then. I thought, even though the spectacular dragon effects are still a marvel today, and I read a lot about how they were made, and I think that's what still stands out about the film today, there's not much else going for it. I also thought it was kind of murky. In, you know, its color scheme, there's a very atonal soundtrack by Alex North that really doesn't help a lot in like elevating the action. It felt to me when I started watching it, it felt a little bit like Excalibur of the same year in terms of the, you know, the dark look of fantasy. But then, of course, Excalibur has so much more going for it, also visually, that I thought, ah, oh, no, this is really kind of brown, gray, mushy fantasy with great dragons, and that's about it. It also didn't leave a big impression, you know. I don't really remember a lot of it except for, you know, the standout scenes. So it seems a little forgettable, to be quite mean about it. So it's really the movie of those three that we watched for today that I almost immediately kind of forgot, which is not a good sign, I think.
I mean, I think it is forgettable, and I don't think I'll be in a rush to rewatch it. I would say one thing that I really enjoyed about the dragon, and I think this is, again, something I feel is related to the genre from this era, is watching it, you can see how it's done. You know, it's not, you're not there sort of jaw-dropping, like, did they have a real dragon here? You can watch it and think, well, that was a puppet. That was a puppet that they're playing tricks with scale. That's just a large model they've created. This is just how they shoot around it. So you see claws, you see everything done like that way. still works as an adult. I still enjoy watching it, even though it has this capacity of, I know what they're doing. I know that's a matte painting, but it's a beautiful matte painting. I know that that's just an animatronic, that's like a puppet of a claw that they've put, but it's a really impressive puppet. And there's something, the dragon scenes had that quality so well that clearly creating the dragon was obviously a bit of an ILM labor of love. I can imagine the team really going all out to say, we want to create the best dragon that's ever been in cinema. It just deserved to star in a better film. If I was that dragon, I wouldn't have come out my trailer for this. I would have walked out and demanded that the studio send me better scripts, because it deserves a better film for what it is. Which at no point is mysterious, but it is still impressive. And I think that's the really strong point, I think, taken out of Dragonslayer, because that is something of this genre that I know how they're doing this, but it is still so much fun to watch something like that done on this scale, that there's an artistry to that that you could admire.
Absolutely. I mean, if you watch something like, let's say, Conan from this time, which is a much more grounded fantasy. You don't have the big creature effects. Conan is a better film in every respect. It's better written. But as a kid, I would have watched that one and missed, you know, the fantastic creatures, because I think that's what got me into fantasy, you know, dragons and monsters and beasts and stuff. And obviously dwarves and elves and all of that. But seeing a dragon in motion was cool. I mean, this was also, I'd read about dragons, I'd seen animated dragons, and then seeing the puppetry in this, I would have loved this. But I think there is stuff in this film that makes you think, with a better script, this could have been a minor classic. And I think the darkness that you mentioned, Alan, is a part of it, and I think the darkness goes together with the tactile quality. I mean, as you say, there are some pretty gnarly deaths in this. And again, I think this is very much post-Star Wars, because if you remember the first Star Wars, I remember as a kid being struck by how dark the death of Luke's aunt and uncle are. You know, when he comes back and there you've got the smoldering skeletons of them. This is not kind of, you know, someone vanishing in a flash of light and then they're gone. There's something, again, tactile to this. And I think you have the same thing here. The deaths are tactile. And I think that makes it more memorable. I mean, if I will remember anything, it will be the horrible death and what happens to her post-death of the princess, or the Ian McDiarmid character getting burned to a crisp. It's stuff like that. And I think that darkness, as you said, is also something very much that I think of when it comes to supposedly kids' entertainment in the 80s, possibly early 90s. That there wasn't this fear of, oh, you know, you shouldn't traumatize the little ones. Traumatize us. That's what we wanted as kids.
Yeah, and I think watching it, you know, I also thought, I mean, the big dragon movie that I grew up with was then Dragonheart, you know, just the next step on the way of away from tactile fantasy to the first fully computer animated dragon, obviously with the voice of Sean Connery. But it's interesting that this gave Dragonheart its standout quality. It was Connery's voice, right? It was something very relatable, that the dragon had a personality. Obviously, it wasn't an evil dragon. It turned out to be a very nice dragon. But I think the CGI dragon was the one that I probably was at the right age to really marvel at this new non-tactile quality of it. So it's a very much more cleaned up version, much less dark, much less horrible than Dragonslayer is. But yeah, those are really the memorable moments here in Dragonslayer, right?
Definitely. And I think it's that, I suppose, tactile quality of the dragon that I think segues quite nicely into the film that you picked, Sam, because when it comes to everything being on camera in the fantasy, I think this is probably peak 80s tactile fantasy. So which film did you pick, Sam?
I brought along The Dark Crystal, another movie that I'd seen as a child, I have to admit. None of the films that we discussed today were early childhood favorites, but of course I had heard of it. I'd seen pictures. I was quite a big fan of The Muppets randomly on television, but again, The Muppets were kind of over at the same time already. They were just on reruns. So it was not something that I ever had a chance to see. So I was very curious when we discussed tactile fantasy. I thought, well, there's nothing more tactile than trying to make an entire film just with puppets. And Frank Oz and Jim Henson obviously trying this turn at a dark fantasy story that really is also quite horrible in its details of showing, you know, the creatures and the deaths and just the dark details of these two worlds colliding, and quite a generic hero story, I would say, on the whole. but also a very allegorical one, right? The good world and the bad world that are joined together, that are kind of mirror images of each other. So I was very curious to bring that to the table and say, well, is that the ultimate tactile fantasy you can get of that era? And what do we make of it seeing it today? Well, now that the Muppets are, you know, being revived, and obviously puppets kind of, not sure if they make a comeback, but there's also this longing for maybe a similar thing in all the post-CGI or in the middle of CGI world. So I'm very curious to see, of course, what you made of it. Were you aware of it? Did you see it at the time? What was your relationship to Dark Crystal?
I mean, this is one I really strongly remember when it was released, going to the cinema, getting absolutely caught up in it. It still amazes me how epic it feels. I still get that twinge of, this feels like a huge story when I watch it. And it's not a long film. But as a kid, it felt like, you know, a Lord of the Rings extended edition. I was swept away by it. I was absolutely caught up. And it builds to, you know, what is, if maybe not that visually, but it is, sort of feels like quite an epic conclusion about what we've watched has led to this moment. And I just really enjoyed it for that by removing all humans from the story and saying, we are going to tell this in a completely puppet set built world. If you can get into that wavelength, it's completely immersive. You absolutely buy that as its own world, to a level that I think you can't get in films where puppets interact with humans. Because I think having human characters there help you. They are your crutch into this world. They are your eyes and ears getting into the world of the fantasy. And that's really useful. If you don't have it, you're just going to, right, I'm going to have to accept that everything that looks like a puppet is a person, and then buy into their world that looks like this. And as a kid, absolutely did that. And it's interesting that sort of the lack of humans in this was seen as one of the reasons why it probably failed at the box office. And that led to Labyrinth, which was like a Henson film where they centered it on humans interacting with puppets. I can kind of see in many respects that Labyrinth is a better film, and it's certainly a more commercially minded film. But I just love the madness at the heart of Dark Crystal, that it is 100% Henson puppetry. And you have to go with it. If you're not willing to buy into this, this film will have very little for you. But if you are, it is an epic fantasy. And that's still my sort of feeling about it. How about you, Matt? What was your take on it?
Since you mentioned Labyrinth, I would say that Labyrinth obviously has another special effect, that is Jennifer Connelly. And if you're a young teenage guy during that time, I think depending on, you know, what you're into, you've got Jennifer Connelly to have a crush on, or you have David Bowie to have a crush on. Or I guess if you're into that, you have the puppets to have a crush on. I don't know, whatever. But I think there's definitely enough there, you know, for all kind of tastes. Teenage tastes. The Dark Crystal was one of those films that at the time I didn't see, I wanted to see, but I saw the making of, and I loved the making of. I was fascinated. There were these scenes with these land striders. So yeah, these fantastic creatures, which, you know, compared to a dragon, the dragon in Dragon Slayer was cool, but dragons are also kind of generic. If you imagine fantasy, you imagine dragons. This film, The Dark Crystal, had creatures and beings that were much more original, much more unique. And I think that's also where its great strength lies. It is a film that evokes a world that is unlike anything else that we have in regular fantasy or in generic fantasy. Problem is, I saw the film only in my 20s, and at that time I felt that the film I had imagined was better than the actual film. And I think part of this is that I agree with you, Alan. It was a good decision not to have any human characters in this. The problem is that the closest we have to human characters, the human stand-ins, the Gelflings, are by far the weakest puppets in this film. You've got all the other puppets, which are more cartoonish to some extent, but they're expressive. And then you've got the Gelflings, and they are terribly lifeless. Their faces just don't do well at expressing emotion in a believable way. So I never bought the Gelflings, which are the protagonists of this story, as characters. I also think that the story to some extent is a bit too much, you know, an old hippie writing a story for old hippies. And because of that, I think there's a lot here which is just too slow. I like slow films, but here you have all these repeated shots of the mystics, which are basically the good guy puppets moving towards the, you know, the climax. And basically it gets boring once you have the fifth and the sixth and the seventh shot of these old guys moving very slowly across the land to the castle. I had enough of it. And the problem was, I was watching it with other people also in their 20s, early 30s, who also felt, no, this is boring, which is a shame, because As a world, this is fantastic. As a world, this is definitely, of the three films that we have here, the one that I find most fascinating. And in that respect, I would say the film holds up, especially for the world it evokes, less so for the story it tells, and much less so for the characters it uses to tell the story. What I like, again, you've mentioned this already, there is some wonderfully evocative darkness here. There is basically several characters are drained of their essence, which sounds weirdly like Doctor Strangelove. But it would have been the perfect nightmare for children watching this. I think even as a, you know, now in my early 50s, I still think these scenes are effective. And I would say that with The Dark Crystal, I can see why this became a favorite of some people, even if I think that the film is flawed as a film, as a story, because Jim Henson's puppetry is tactile and it has personality, minus the Gelflings. And it is clearly the golden age, I think, of puppetry. We very recently saw Little Shop of Horrors, and there's the link there to Frank Oz, who directed that film and who worked closely on this film. And the puppets, I mean, basically they knew how to make puppets be characters. It just doesn't work with the Gelflings, which is a shame.
How about you, Sam?
Well, it's interesting. If the 20s are the wrong age to watch it and, you know, your childhood is the perfect age, I think the mid-40s are quite a good age too to watch this, because I love this. I thought this was so, not adorable, that sounds too cute, but I really marveled at the artistry and I thought this is really a lost art, and it felt almost a little sad to watch this and to imagine that this was, you know, a big movie at the time. And today this would all be made obviously with the best possible CGI technology, and I'm sure it would look great, maybe look even better in some parts. But for me, it's the perfect combination of the puppets in the foreground, the matte painting in the background, the real locations that they used, the epic feel that you mentioned, Alan, that I also thought was part of it, the look of the images, the colors, the music, the Trevor Jones score that I think I knew from way back and now finally saw with the images. So I was completely immersed and just enjoyed it, even though I agree with you, Matt, that the Gelflings are the weakest link here. But I think everything else is so good and is so such standout villains as well, with the Skeksis and their counterparts and Augura. You know, it's such a good character as well. Billy Whitelaw's voice I saw in the credits, and I was like, of course she's such a standout character. It's like an excellent actress voicing. It's also the dubbing, I think, was really worked well to give these puppets proper characters, which is, of course, something that Henson and Oz had perfected over the years. So I think this is really their pet project to bring things to perfection in a very different context. And I think I was just, you know, marveling at the outcome, how this turned out. I can also totally see how it developed into a cult movie that people really started to appreciate it much after the fact, and kind of seeing it not only a lost world, but this like lost art of filmmaking where every detail is put in place and counts and you can sense it. I think that, again, the tactile effect of this is really 100%. So yeah, no, I must say I'm glad I saw it now for the first time. I'm not sure how I would have reacted with a more, you know, at a more cynical age or teenage or whatever that is. But yeah, it's a keeper, I think. I want to rewatch it.
I mean, it's very interesting in terms of saying how we're talking about the lost art of puppetry, because I think there's a very interesting sort of second chapter to this. This is sort of a while back, probably slightly pre-COVID, Netflix. I have this theory about Netflix that the books will be written about a certain era of streaming service where they had so much money. And they spent money on insane things that people will look back on and go, what were you thinking? And some of that insanity is quite brilliant. And I will include on that on Netflix, there is a prequel to The Dark Crystal that is 10 episodes long that is effectively done with puppets. They were trying to rediscover how this was done. It was originally, I think, they were planning it as animation, and then Netflix turned around and said, we've got giant bags of money. Why don't you do it like the film was made? They launched it in London, so it had a big sort of Netflix TV show premiere. And I went to the launch, and they'd done the whole cinema out with sets, with puppets, with everything like that related to what they'd made for it. And I think it stood as like a visual testament that there was so much fun in this that they kind of hadn't really written a story. So you get into this world of world creation, which Dark Crystal does really well, And there's a beauty to making sets. And I think part of the beauty from the sets becomes because you have to think about it. If you've got puppets, you have to think very creatively as to how to make a set work. And if you're thinking in that much detail anyway, I think you end up creating these beautifully detailed sets because it's like, we're going to see it from this angle and we're going to have to hide the hand this way. Those things need to look incredibly real. And so you end up with these beautiful detailed sets. And the Netflix show is really interesting because it has that quality. It's an amazing feat of puppetry. But at no point did anyone seem to think, can this really sustain like 10 episodes? And also it being a prequel, 10 episodes that aren't really going to end anywhere because the story has to sort of fit into the Dark Crystal. So you know that this isn't, there isn't a level of unpredictability. And how they get around that is, let's just have the characters go to another part of this world. And this is a fantasy realm where they're a bit like the Gelflings, but they can fly. And this is another fantasy realm where these different really striking puppet creatures. And it has this quality of just like, we're going to show you all this beautiful stuff we can do. And I feel to some extent that's a logical end point of romanticizing what the Dark Crystal does, that you end up celebrating its puppetry to this huge extent, like 10 episodes on Netflix. But also with the caveat that if you've not got the story, it's a weird thing to sort of sit through. You are looking at something admiringly, but you're not being told a great story. I would definitely recommend the Netflix series, but I think you need that love of puppetry or you are going to bounce off it pretty hard. Have either of you seen the Netflix show?
We watched the first episode of it. And I think, yeah, I loved the artistry. I loved the puppetry. Story-wise, it felt very much like they're continuing what the film does, i.e. not telling a very good story, but telling it extremely well with the puppets. And puppets, I think, are a strange thing. I mean, it goes a bit towards what you said earlier about the dragon in Dragon Slayer. If you watch a puppet, you're always aware that you're watching a puppet. You know that there's someone, you know, to put it somewhat crudely, with their hand up its bum. But when it works, I mean, look at some of the behind-the-scenes footage of the Muppets. You have the puppeteers working the puppets, but the puppets still come alive. You know that they are being worked by the puppeteers, but you still have conversations between the puppets and the puppeteers, and you buy into them. So you have this double vision thing where you know it's a puppet and it still comes alive. If it works, they come alive in a way that is almost magic. And it's magic because you know it is puppetry and they still come alive. Your brain should tell you this is not real and your brain still buys into it. And I think that to some extent is potentially at least more magical than the best CGI that is completely hidden. You don't even know that it's an effect. I like the fact of the magic being visible, the wires and the threads and everything, and you still come to buy into it.
I mean, I think the ultimate example of that is Kermit the Frog. He looks at the camera when things are going wrong with such a sense of despair. And he doesn't, his eyes don't move. He's not got many features on his face. He has to do it all with the movement and with maybe the mouth a bit. But just like Kermit is such an emotional puppet. And there's so little there, but you know, if you've got the skill, you can give him these sort of very human qualities when he's reacting to the environment in such a way that seems really human. I do think that's such a high art of puppetry. And it's interesting how it works really well in the Muppets when there's humans to interact. And I think it's a different quality in the Dark Crystal, which has its pros and cons when you don't have humans to interact with them. It's puppets reacting to puppets, it's puppets all the way down. And I think that has a different quality to it that I really like in Dark Crystal. I'm not sure whether I could watch it endlessly. I think the TV series, I got to the end and they don't really resolve anything at the end of 10 episodes because I think they were hoping for a second series. So it really is 10 episodes of treading water, which if you know would be a very hard thing to visualize with a puppet. You'd have to create legs and put them in water and it would look very odd. But it has that feeling. And I think there is something about having humans that works really well. And I think it is something in this genre that humans interacting with puppets, it can bring both to the next level.
Look at Empire Strikes Back, the scenes with Yoda and Luke. They work so brilliantly.
I was just going to say Yoda came to mind a couple of times, which to me is one of the greatest instances of puppet and other creatures and actors, real life actors interacting on screen. And it's completely, you know, suspension of disbelief. And I think that's a great dramatic example. But I think the Muppets also work so well because I think it's light, it's humorous, right? And I think it's also the repetition of the effect over many, many shows and seasons. And you know a little bit the personality of Miss Piggy and Gonzo and Kermit and so on. So I think it also works really well because you recognize the cartoonish basic character and then you throw them into a new situation or you make them interact with a new star of that episode. I think the Muppets will have a much better time being revived than Dark Crystal was. I didn't see the series in 2019. I heard of it and I'm curious to maybe also check out a couple of episodes. But I think that's the puppetry that might still work. It's like cult characters thrown in new context. And we all remember, right, when Yoda for the first time was no longer a puppet, the outcry that was on the one hand and how that changed the effect of the character on screen as well. So I think that's almost the best example of that to me.
I mean, another sort of interesting example of what I think would still work in terms of combining puppetry with humans is from Labyrinth. And it is, I can't remember his name, the sort of goblin friend that she acquires is a Hoggle, which is a small person with a very animated mask and someone else doing the voice. And this combination of animatronics has a reality to it that I think still works. I think if you watch it, it has a real life. It feels like an upgrade almost on a puppet in some respects. And I think that's all really interesting that like this was the 80s where they thought, can we do this? Can we make this work? An animatronic mask on an actor in this sort of context. And I think it does. I think it's a shame that there aren't more examples of it. I think if you were pushing things, as I think Jim Henson always was, you then are creating stuff like this that really works. And yeah, I mean, it's more animatronics, but it still has a quality of puppetry because there's a human acting behind the mask who's doing a lot of the body language. And there's a human creating the voice with the range of a voice actor. And the combination feels like puppetry, even though it isn't a hand puppet. In the end, you can work out how they did it, but it's ambitious use of it, which I really enjoy. I suppose it's that ambition that is something in this genre that I'm a huge fan of. And I think ambition mixed with insanity brought me to what I sort of picked for this film, which was Terry Gilliam's Adventures of Baron Munchausen. I think Terry Gilliam is quite a key figure in this 80s genre in terms of he was very much into making the fantastical. He was very much making the fantastical by spending a lot of money on sets, on the designs of everything. He had a dark sense of humor. So I think he brought a lot of darkness to the genre at the time. And I think Baron Munchausen is kind of the pinnacle of all these trends in terms of size, in terms of the expense. I mean, it was a hugely, it was, I think it was said at the time, although people question it, it was the most expensive film ever made. And it was also a huge flop. And so you have this idea of creating so many fantastical scenarios, actually tactile, doing it for real and spending quite large sums of money doing it for real. And watching it now, you know that's what they're doing. At no point do you really feel like you're there. You're in this world of huge sets that are having animatronics done to it or they're shooting around things to give you the impression of something. But it's all there. It's all being thrown in the film alongside a sort of slightly insane script, a story about imagining, a story about making things up. And it's this massively crazy beast that I love, but also will accept it doesn't quite work, but also seems to have been maybe the death knell for making films this way because it lost so much money. And then if people are coming along and said, you know what, we could have done so much of this in a computer and you wouldn't have to spend 3 weeks trying to capture a particular special effects shot. Just get some people with computers to do it and you've got someone riding a cannonball. And I think it probably discredited the idea of doing everything like this. Which is a shame, but I think the fact that they did everything like this is also why it's so much fun to watch. And again, it was interesting. I remember seeing it in the cinema, loving it, and then coming back to it with some trepidation, thinking how well has it aged, and still really enjoying it, still sort of loving its energy, while also, like I said, being aware that I don't think it's quite perfect, but... How did you guys feel watching it, starting with you, Sam?
I think it's absolutely insane as a film to think about that this was produced. I came to it having read a chapter in Tim Robey's book, Box Office Poison, which really detailed the way into it becoming apparently a financial disaster and going over budget. And it was that whole story. And then I read the piece by Sarah Polley in The Guardian that was published, I think, 4 or 5 years ago about her experiences as a child actress in that film. And I think that caused quite a stir and put, you know, Terry Gilliam's direction of the film in question, of all the horrible things she went through in the making of this film. So kind of the hell that she described. So I had a very also trepidations of actually watching the film. I think it's lengthy in many stretches. You know, there's these patches of boredom, I think one critic wrote, that are quite problematic. I watched it on a very small screen on the train. So I must say maybe the visuals also had less of an effect on me. But I must say that through all of that, you still have to admire the outcome. I think I watched this and I was like, oh my God, the investment that was made to make this possible. I was imagining these sets and then Cinecittà Studios probably ruining themselves on that film, pulling all the stops, throwing these stars into there, like Robin Williams especially has a very meaty part in there. He's absolutely insane. I mean, I know Williams can do a lot, but here that's one of the craziest roles I've ever seen him in. But you know what I enjoyed is this like 18th century context, obviously, that the big confabulator that Münchhausen is, and how he appears at the theater first as an actor and then as the supposedly real version, this whole framing of the age of reason versus the age of fabulation. I think that worked really well for me. It reminded me of these 18th century novels that we were put through at the University of Bern and that I really did not enjoy to begin with. But then I enjoyed this juxtaposition of, you know, the reasonable and the scientific that came out in that age versus people who just said, let's just tell a crazy story and let people not be quite sure if that is really true or if it's just like a made up story. But it's like fun. It's got everything you need for a great story. And I think with John Neville as this kind of deadpan version of Münchhausen, I really enjoyed his face as a projection of our, I don't know, reactions to the film, to the scenes. I think it was an enjoyable watch in the end. I kind of forgot about the lengthy parts and at the end found it kind of cheerful to have watched it despite all the madness. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's how I came away from it.
How about you, Matt?
I mean, the weird thing is when you mentioned this film as your choice for this episode, my first thought was, but it's not a fantasy film. Obviously it is, but my thinking there was what I think of as fantasy basically is very much the Lord of the Rings template. It's fantasy where the fantastic is presented as real. These worlds exist. These worlds have a kind of ontological reality, so to speak. And obviously, Münchhausen's story is one of tall tales. He invents, he lies, he makes things up. And the film even kind of plays with that. How much of this is real? None of it, all of it, half of it. We get the impression that what we're seeing is his tales, his imagination. And because of that, they don't have a base reality. And that's why I at first thought, but, you know, this is basically just tall tales being visualized. But to some extent, that's what all fantasy is, of course. I definitely like that this has a very different quality, namely a storybook quality, also in the visuals, which reminds me very much of this is a Czechoslovak 1961 film, The Fabulous Baron Munchausen by Karel Zeman. And it's partly animated to look like these original Gustave Doré illustrations. And I think this film has the same quality. I would say it's clearly the best film of the three that we're talking about here. But I also think it shows both the obvious strengths and very obvious weaknesses of Terry Gilliam as a director. He has a massive lack of structure, discipline, and he tends to go for tonal mishmashes that sometimes work and sometimes not. I don't like the film as a whole. I love many of its elements, though. My problem is I've really soured on Terry Gilliam. I mean, for one thing, he's not aged well as a person, but also he is so enamored of his every idea that he works in everything. And sometimes that works in short form. I think, for instance, the stuff that he did for Monty Python, because it's 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and then it's over, works better. If he extends it over an entire film, it can become grating. And I find his central theme of imagination storytelling over evil reason struck me as self-serving this time around. There's a glibness to the humor and also a sexist quality, which, especially knowing more about Terry Gilliam, rubbed me the wrong way. And I think there's also this thing. I love Gilliam's Brazil, but that has Tom Stoppard as one of the writers, and he's a better writer than both Gilliam is and his co-writer, Charles McCone. But the film is extremely effective when it comes to visualizing the fantastic. I really love, again, the tactility. I love the theatricality of it, which is something that the two other films do not have. There's a foregrounded craftedness to the images, which I really love. I mean, take, for instance, the Moon Cityscape, where you've got these flat illustrations. It's totally theater. It doesn't go for a let's hide the special effects, let's make people believe that this is real. And I love that. What I found interesting was, of these three films, this is actually the one that does have some use of early CGI. It's used quite interestingly. It isn't used to, again, make things look real or realistic, but it uses CGI to make something that looks much more like the illustrations in a book, which I think is quite neat.
I think that's definitely something coming back to it, is there's an element to which Terry Gilliam, you sort of learn more about him, and then when you go back to the earlier films, sort of realizing that it has been there all the time, that there is a quality to these films that, you know, it wasn't hidden. It is sort of quite a misogynistic film, and it's what seemed like an arrogance of, I'm going to do it this way, I'm going to make it so over the top. Suddenly you see a lot more of the arrogance related to that. And, you know, someone who wasn't going to listen, someone who wasn't going to compromise. Well, yeah, but that also includes, how are you treating the people you're working with? And it is sort of something coming back to Gilliam, that you sort of notice it, because I think, a bit like Woody Allen, it was hiding in plain sight. It's there in the film. But I do think, I do have a very soft spot, I think, that it does work cinematically for me. My favorite Gilliam stuff is the films, because I think there's something in letting that imagination run riot that I actually enjoy. I can kind of see why people find it boring. I occasionally rewatch a Gilliam film, and I think I must be in the brain state of a lot of other people, because I'm sort of halfway through Time Bandits and I'm thinking, I'm actually bored. And then I watch it again another time and I am swept along by it. The level of madness to fill a film of that, I find quite joyous. And I don't know, sometimes I'm just in the right mood and sometimes I'm not. And I think Baron Munchausen is probably the best encapsulation of that. That if you're not into the insanity, then this film is going to go nowhere. This film doesn't have anything more than a director telling you about, all I do is lie, everything I do is lie, but I'm going to make it the biggest lies possible. And then you might believe it. And I'm not a very nice person. I'm very arrogant. It is the most Gilliam of Gilliam films. And I think it is so central to this like tactile 80s genre. I think he's a huge part of that. I think he's a huge influence on it. And then he makes this film, which is kind of a pinnacle of it, that kind of, to some extent, kills off the genre, which is a shame. And I, across the board, I wish there was more strong storytelling in this genre. Because I was sort of trying to think about films that I would say fall within this. And, you know, we've mentioned sort of Willow, Legend, Labyrinth. But I think there's also Return to Oz, which is this beautifully dark sequel to The Wizard of Oz that we've talked about before, which very much fits in this world. But there's also stuff like The Company of Wolves. I don't know if you've seen that, which I think also feels a little bit like it belongs in this world of, we are doing it for real. We are doing a sort of tactile world that is also an adult story. And I kind of feel it's a shame that as a genre, it never broke out of being, for want of a better word, Gilliam-esque. Like, you're watching this to enjoy what we've done. And it is cool. It is amazing. But there's just not stories. The stories are never quite there. And in the end, they said, well, we've not really got a story, but we can focus on the dragon and we will give you a really good dragon. And I think my one sort of regret, sort of thinking about the films to pick and what films weren't picked, is there's so few great stories. And I think that's a real shame.
I mean, I totally agree. I think all three of the films where they work least is definitely the story. I mean, Dragon Slayer feels like a kid's first D&D campaign, and it's not a very good D&D campaign. The Dark Crystal has a fantastic world, but the story is definitely the weakest part of it. And Baron Munchausen, the story is, of course, very episodic. It has to be by design. I think it's one where the story works best, but in a way where the spirit of tactile fantasy has survived, and very often the storytelling is better, is in the best of stop motion animation. If you look at what Laika Studio does, I think it very much has this tactility, it has the puppetry, it has, I think, the spirit of much of what I like about these films. but also because it is stop motion, because, you know, you're going to work on this for years and years and years. Just getting a second of footage takes so much painstaking work. You know that you also need to have a good story. You need to have good characters. And I think for me, that is where the spirit has survived to some extent. More so probably than in films nowadays, which are supposedly or at least partly fantastic. And there I see very little of the spirit of the 80s tactile fantasy.
And I was wondering, you know, the one other thing that connects these three films is that they were not big hits. They did not influence more and more films to be the same way. They're quite unique in a way, or they did not have a major cultural influence on, you know, do we have to repeat the success? And I think it would be interesting to see if Munchausen had been this massive hit. And I think anything at Columbia Studios kind of worked against it, and they released it very in limited releases in the US. And it was just didn't happen. But I think it also didn't happen because of the film itself and how it landed. And maybe see which other fantasy films around that same time did have major success. I'm thinking of, I mean, even though Hook wasn't a massive success a few years later, but the big studio-based fantasy film that came out kind of next, that to me was Hook. And the Spielbergian way of fantasy had such a bigger influence on whatever came after. And I wonder if this crazy Terry Gilliam way of doing it was also kind of superseded by something much more, you know, saccharine, sweet, Spielberg influenced. And the Terry Gilliam versions of that were kind of, yeah, didn't go anywhere in terms of the box office, but might have survived to have a cult following like all of these films did. So they did have an influence, but not right on like mainstream fantasy culture, but they stuck around. That's also something that connects the three.
I think it's interesting that no one would make a film nominally for kids that is as dark as the films they made in the 80s. That just seems to be a complete like non-starter. So that darkness has been extricated out of it. And yeah, it's interesting whether the influence is more, well, we're not going to do it that way anymore. We're not going to make a film that way anymore. We're not going to be dark like that anymore because we had this run of failures in the 80s. So let's try something else. And I think it is interesting that like fantasy, I think really sort of struggled as a genre sort of into the 90s and into the 2000s, that like more overt science fiction or a sort of more contemporary action with sort of slightly outlandish plots was really where cinema was going. And it's not till, I guess, the Lord of the Rings that you have this sort of coming together of some of these tricks, but with CGI. But then, of course, you've already got the pre-made story. You've got these tracks set down, and it still sort of lacks a level of darkness that I think are in these films. I think the Lord of the Rings, which I do admire, it feels quite streamlined in a way that these films aren't. And again, possibly better for it. I think the lack of that streamline, the more insanity, the slightly chaotic way these films were made is one of the things I think I really get out of them. And I do miss that because with the way budgets are, with the way things work, no one is going to set out to make a film like these were made. I mean, they'll make a very bad fantasy film, but the reason won't be that they were in the chaos these people were. It was because the studios are terrible at making imaginative films. But I think it's really interesting, as I think we sort of mentioned with the disaster film, that like how it sort of maybe survived in other ways, but ultimately it is gone. And I think it's the same here. You can see influences, and they're obviously cult films. And I think people who make films do reference these films when they talk about what they wanted to do. But as a genre, it is dead. I don't think it's gonna come back unless some hipsters will spend a bit of money to make their own puppet film, which will do well, and then there'll be a flood of awful ones, and then it'll all go moribund again. But it's just an interesting era to me that coincides with my childhood, so I really enjoy it for that. Are there any sort of films from this era we haven't talked about that either of you feel are worth a mention? I think we've given a bit of an overview, but any that we've missed?
I would say I wished for this episode, you know, if we did a sequel to this episode, I wonder if better films of that era would have also given us a very different discussion. I'd love to rewatch, you know, we mentioned Willow and Legend, but also something like Krull or The Neverending Story that I mentioned at the beginning, just to see, you know, would we feel the same? So I think this made me really want to watch more films of that era and see, well, which are the gems? Obviously, you could also watch Empire Strikes Back and, you know, really famous examples. But I'd be curious to see if we could get more out of this tactile 80s fantasy with better films.
How about you, Matt?
I mean, basically, it's already been mentioned. I think some of the creativity in these films probably went rather into sci-fi afterwards for several reasons. Sci-fi was a bigger moneymaker, one thing. And the other thing was perhaps also the more technologically minded sci-fi, even when it was tactile, was perhaps easier. Creating fantastic creatures that are believable is difficult. And I think the films that we have manage it really well. But it is more difficult than spaceships with the hard edges. And, you know, an X-Wing flying around is going to be easier to do credibly than a creature, even though Star Wars did creatures really well. But yeah, I miss the puppetry. And I think some of the best CGI that comes around later very much goes back to some of the techniques of animation, of puppetry, of stop motion animation, and blend the two things. I think CGI can be used to capture some of that spirit, again, not to the same extent. But I mean, if you look at The Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance, I think it's called, you know, it's got one of those terribly memorable subtitles. From what I saw, they used CGI quite heavily, but they used CGI to add to the puppetry, not to supplement it. But yeah, fantasy, I think, also benefited and suffered from the Lord of the Rings films, because that's what people imagine now when they hear fantasy. Or perhaps at this point, people, when they hear fantasy, they imagine Game of Thrones. The more tactile fantasy of what we're talking about, I really think the spirit, as I said, if anywhere, it's in stop motion animation. But I don't think we're going to see the likes of these films, as you've said, Alan, which is sad.
I mean, the only thing that, you know, maybe a tiny sliver of hope is the alleged story about the Mandalorian TV show, the first TV series, and they were shooting it, and Werner Herzog is in the first few episodes. And, you know, the story is the Mandalorian acquires what became known as Baby Yoda, and they were shooting with a puppet. And at one point they said to Werner Herzog, oh yeah, we're going to replace that when it's broadcast. The puppet is a guide for our animators. The story is that Werner Herzog like called them cowards, and you know, you should shoot the puppet. And so there is a bit of sort of puppetry sort of early on, but I think progressively they just think it's easier to do CGI. And I think that there is a quality to CGI that allows you to not have to spend the period of time that all these films require. And I think that can be a good thing, but I think it also takes away maybe a level of quality control in the visuals. That because you had to prepare the set, you had to prepare everything, you took the time, it was a level of quality control that had to be built in, or you didn't have anything. Whereas I think now a producer can think, oh yeah, we have this scene, we'll do it by CGI and we'll give them a week. And so you watch a film and it just has, they think they can get away with it because you'll get something with CGI that is very bland. But I think with puppetry, because that level of preparation, you had to do it. A studio couldn't go, oh, we'll get that giant puppet, you know, massacre done. We'll give them a couple of days. You know, you had to think, right, how are we going to do this? We have to work all around it. We're going to have to do everything about it. That, I think, created a level of visual quality control that I think you don't necessarily have with CGI. And again, I think I really enjoy rewatching these for this. And I think it's been tremendous fun going back on this. I will add, actually, Sam, there are better films than the three, but I think our conversation would ultimately skirt back after we watch Krull to go, there's bits of it that are good, but they're just, Willow's the same. That just isn't the story. I think ultimately it'll all come back to that, but I did really enjoy rewatching these, and I'll thank you guys like for coming along on the trip with me today for our journey into tactile fantasy, and join us again soon for another damn fine cup of culture. Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.